This is Midday on WNYC, and I'm Jamie Floyd, so pleased to be hosting today. And up first, Maya K. Van Rossum. Her new book, The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment, offers a brief but comprehensive look at the power of environmental constitutionalism to affect change for activists. We'll explain to you just what that is in a moment. Maya Van Rossum is a veteran environmentalist. She joined the Delaware Riverkeeper Network in 1994 as executive director and has championed the rights of people to a free-flowing, clean, and healthy Delaware River and its tributary streams. In 2013, she was a petitioner in a landmark case, Robinson Township v. Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which strengthens Pennsylvania's environmental amendment to its constitution. And now she wants to export that legal strategy to every state in the union. The Green Amendment is published by Disruption Books, and Maya Van Rossum is here in our studios to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you open your book with a story we've been hearing a lot about, fracking, companies assuring residents that there will be no damage to their property resulting from the drilling. It's so easily disproven, so how do they keep convincing property owners otherwise?
Well, unfortunately, this is the playbook of so many industrial operators when it comes to business versus the environment. They really try to make it exactly that, business versus the environment. And they invest a lot of money in marketing schemes to try to peddle false narratives, false facts, to try to get people to buy into supporting their industrial operations, despite the fact that it is devastating lives.
And you open with a very personal story, which really draws the reader in. And explain to us what the lure is initially to property owners of these fracking leases. Why would people say yes?
Well, the industrial operators send out landmen who go to people's homes, and they promise them lots of money in exchange for extracting gas out of their ground. And they also assert that it'll result in absolutely no environmental harm, and that when they leave, they'll put the land and the landscape back the way it was before they arrived. And that's simply not the fact. That's not true. What happens is they come in, they devastate the landscape, they pollute water, sometimes drinking water supplies, they pollute the air, they take more land than they promise, and very often the landowners don't get the amount of money that they're promised. So it really is, again, it's a false promise of money and no harm when the exact opposite is the truth.
And so we take a step back, I'll step away from my questions for a moment. We're assuming everybody knows what fracking is, aren't we? Let's take a moment to explain the process. What exactly are we talking about in terms of the environmental impact, in terms of the technology? What is fracking?
So fracking is part of the process of extracting gas from shale. And the industrial operators come in, they clear landscapes, they cut forests, they build well pads as much as 3 acres in size. They bring in thousands of trucks in order to bring in materials to engage in the operation. And then they literally take millions of gallons of water and inject it into the ground very forcefully, water that is contaminated with very serious high levels of toxic contamination. And they force it into the ground in order to shatter the shale in the earth to release little bubbles of gas that are there.
And it is an impact that you have observed firsthand?
Absolutely. I have had the sad misfortune of standing with landowners as they've watched their land and landscapes be fracked and seen the devastation that's left behind. I have sat in kitchens and living rooms and heard families talk about how they've lost the quality of their drinking water, they've lost the quality of their lives, they've lost the ability to have a family party out on the back deck because of the 24/7 noise, light, and pollution, and they've had to witness the degrading health of themselves, their family members, and their children. It's devastating.
And hydraulic fracturing is it's a nickname for hydraulic fracturing. We've all come to call it fracking. And you write in great detail about the noise, the light, and this level of pollution that these communities suffer. And we'll talk about that in greater detail in just a moment. Talk a bit, though, first about the health implications.
So you have pollution of all sorts that results from drilling and fracking operations. And just to be clear, the industry likes, when they talk about fracking, they just like to talk about the portion of the process that is in the injection of this toxic laced water into the ground. When the rest of us talk about fracking, we are really talking about the entire process, including the land clearing, the roadways, the proliferation of pipelines and compressor stations, the entire process from cradle to grave, which is what is so devastating, whether you're talking about water pollution, air pollution, or climate-changing contaminants. The health implications are very wide-ranging because you have so many facets of pollution, again, from the water to the air to the landscapes. So you're talking about hazardous air pollutants being spewed into the air that can cause cancers, childhood leukemia, that contribute to autism and ADD. In terms of drinking water, people have found all kinds of contaminants in their drinking water, so it's no longer safe to drink the water coming out of their faucet. They have to buy bottled water, or the industry has to provide them water buffaloes to provide clean water because it's just not safe to get water out of their faucet. But not only is it not safe to drink that water, but you also hear horrific stories of people who have to leave their windows open all year long because sometimes it's methane that's coming out of that water. And methane is very explosive and it's coming into their homes, so they have to leave their windows open to make their homes safe to live in.
It is not a sight unseen process as the industry once had us believe.
Absolutely not. When you go into the communities where drilling and fracking is happening, it is an eyesore. It is devastating. Even from as soon as you get on the roads, you have to contend with these big, massive trucks barreling down these little local roads. It's just not safe to even drive on the roads.
And yet, your book suggests a single homeowner can sign a lease that would destroy the water and quality of life for the neighborhood and the community.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons why a property owner can sign this lease that has so many devastating impacts for themselves and for others is because under our constitutions, they have the right to the sanctity of their property. They have property rights that are protected. So they have the right to sign away the use of their land for this devastating practice, despite the implications for all of us who live around these sites, but also for future generations in terms of the climate changing impacts.
All right. So this book is very much about the environment, but is also about the law. Let's talk about Act 13. What is or was Act 13?
So despite how easy it was for the drillers and the frackers in the mid-2000s to come into Pennsylvania and overwhelm communities with their industrial operations, for the industry, it really wasn't easy enough. They wanted it to be even easier to overwhelm communities with their devastating practices. So we now know that the industrial operators, the frackers, literally went behind closed doors and wrote a piece of legislation that was passed by the Pennsylvania legislature in 2012 that came to be known as Act 13. And Act 13 did a lot of horrible things. Amongst the things that Act 13 did was that Act 13 removed the rights of communities to limit these industrial drilling and fracking operations to the industrial zone of their communities. And they mandated that drilling and fracking be allowed to happen in every part of every community in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, including as close as 300 feet from people's homes. A well pad could be built 300 feet from a home. Imagine that. Devastating.
Now, how did this manage to pass? Who supported this? How is it that homeowners didn't challenge it? I know we're going to talk about how you challenged it after the fact, but how did this thing pass? You say that the frackers drafted it, but who supported it? Who pushed it through? How did this happen?
Well, all too many politicians in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania supported it and passed it very, very quickly. There was a lot of opposition from municipalities, municipal officials, as well as environmental organizations and individual residents across Pennsylvania. But really, the frackers have done a good job at getting the Pennsylvania politicians into their pockets because they donate a lot of money to their political campaigns. And they've also invested so much money in this false narrative, this false advertising that's out there about the industry, that they gave politicians cover to support Act 13, despite the fact that it was advancing this devastating practice in such devastating ways.
And also hope to the communities that it would bring a better economy, jobs, etc. And ultimately, it did not. And all of the consequences that you've laid out in the first part of your book, the book goes on to show the ways in which your program can be emblematic and the devastation can be emblematic for other communities and other states. And we're going to get to that in a moment. But first, let's talk about the ways in which you challenged Act 13 in the case we mentioned at the beginning, Robinson Township versus Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And I want to say again, my guest is Maya Van Rossum. Her book is The Green Amendment, and it grows out of this case. Tell us about the challenge that you brought. What did you feel was at stake? Why did you bring this litigation, and why that approach?
So very literally, what was at stake, what is at stake with challenging the industrial operators that drill and frack for gas from shale is the health, life, and safety of present and future generations, whether you're talking about water, air, forest, flooding, or climate change. We had been battling drilling and fracking in Pennsylvania for many years with limited success. We had been successful at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network in leading the effort to keep drilling and fracking out of the Delaware River watershed, which was actually one of the precursors to the New York State ban. And to this day, you don't have drilling and fracking in the Delaware River watershed. There is a proposal now to make that moratorium permanent. That's another story, and I hope people will pay attention to that too. But really, we had the stake of present and future generations at issue. So we knew we had to challenge Act 13. The question was, how?
And how did you do that? What was your legal strategy to repeal Act 13?
So there had been a long-ignored constitutional provision in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania known as Article 1, Section 27, which protected in the Bill of Rights section of the Pennsylvania's Constitution the people's right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment.
And I think it's worth taking a moment to read it. The people, this is actually in the Constitution. It's quite something. The people have the right to clean air, pure water, and to the preservation of the natural, scenic, historic, and aesthetic values of the environment. Pennsylvania's public natural resources are the common property of all the people, including generations yet to come. As trustee of these resources, the Commonwealth shall conserve and maintain them for the benefit of all the people. So that was your strategy. That was your sword.
Absolutely. And it's beautiful and powerful language. And the fact that it's in the Bill of Rights section of the Constitution should have made it in so many battles on the environmental front, just as you say, an absolute sword of protection. Unfortunately, while the provision was passed in 1971, very quickly it was, as the Chief Justice at the time said, emasculated by decisions that came out of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which declared that provision just a mere statement of good public policy, but that it really didn't have the force and effect of law the way other provisions in the Bill of Rights sections had. And so it had been ignored for 42 years.
But it was not ignored in this case.
Exactly, because we believed we had reached a moment in time when the industry and Pennsylvania legislators had so far overreached in how they were attacking the environment that maybe we were at the moment in history when we could breathe life back into Article 1, Section 27. And that's exactly what we did with our case.
All right, that's a cliffhanger for you. I'm Jamie Floyd, and I'm speaking with environmentalist and Delaware Riverkeeper Maya K. Van Rossum about her new book, The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment. Later on the show, Susan Ronald tells us about the life of Florence Gould, a wealthy socialite who became embroiled in a money laundering scheme for high-ranking Nazis during World War II. Plus, Daniel Pink will stop by to talk about his new book, When, which looks at the science of perfect timing. You are listening to Midday on WNYC, and we'll be right back after a short break. I'm Jamie Floyd, and I'm speaking with environmentalist and Delaware riverkeeper Maya Van Rossum about her new book, The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment. And as we went to break, we were sitting on the edge of a cliffhanger story, a very important case she was a part of in Pennsylvania, and the case was Robinson Township versus Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, an effort to strengthen Pennsylvania's environmental amendment to its constitution, which had essentially laid dormant as the frackers went to town in the Commonwealth. So what was the outcome?
So the Delaware Riverkeeper Network teamed up with seven towns and a physician to challenge Act 13. And the argument that the Delaware Riverkeeper Network and I as the Delaware Riverkeeper brought to the table through our attorneys was that Act 13 violated the environmental rights of the people of Pennsylvania.
It was unconstitutional.
It was unconstitutional. And we got a very powerful decision. The plurality decision was written by the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and he declared the critical provisions of Act 13 that we were challenging as unconstitutional because they violated the environmental rights of the people of Pennsylvania. And in that moment, he breathed legal life into this constitutional provision.
This right of the people to a clean and pure environment that we just looked at. You have it stated beautifully in your book. You've lifted the language and put it in the book so everyone knows their rights, at least in the state of Pennsylvania, to a clean environment. And now you want to see us export this right to a clean environment to other states and perhaps even to the federal constitution. So let's talk about that. Do you think environmental activists in other states can use constitutional provisions to affect this kind of transformational change? How about here in New York?
Yes, we can use green amendments in states across the nation and at the federal level to hold our government officials to account when they don't protect our environment and our environmental rights. But first, we have to get green amendments in every state across the nation because we only have them in Pennsylvania and Montana.
I was going to ask you how many states have this kind of language in their constitution. One-third of America's states drafted some kind of language like this, but not all of them have adopted. I guess only two actually have language in the Constitution.
You actually have 35 states that have language in the Constitution, but there are only two states that place this protection in the Bill of Rights section of their Constitution using exactly the right language to give the legal strength that is necessary to put environmental rights on par with the other political rights that we hold dear, like the right to free speech.
That's what I wanted to ask you.
So, freedom of religion and property rights.
So you equate this right to a clean environment, the right of the people to live in a clean environment, a clean earth, to the right to free speech, the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, all of the rights that are in the Bill of Rights.
Absolutely, because obviously, right, we need water and air and healthy soils to grow healthy foods. We need these things to be clean and healthy to literally survive and have good quality healthy lives and good quality healthy economies. So it is not just imperative, but it is absolutely right that our right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment should be given the highest level of recognition and protection under the law that you can have in the United States of America. And that means placing it in the Bill of Rights section of every state constitution and the federal constitution.
And so you want that to happen beyond, obviously, Pennsylvania and Montana. And in those states that have this kind of language, you want it to be uplifted to the level of the Bill of Rights so that it has equal status with those rights that we consider primary.
Yes. And so, for example, in New York State, there is language in the Constitution about the environment, but it in Article 14, but it talks about either land preservation or it talks about protecting water and air as good policy, but it doesn't talk about it as a right on par with the right to free speech and freedom of religion.
A right of the people.
That's right. And in New Jersey, for example, that's one of the 15 states that don't talk about the environment at all in their constitution. And wonderfully, since we've gotten this Green Amendment movement going, and I have to give credit where credit is due, we have absolutely, in partnership with Environmental Advocates of New York, we have been successful in getting a constitutional provision proposed here in the state of New York by Assemblyman Engelbreit and Senator Carlucci, and we have a constitutional provision being proposed in the state of New Jersey. But in both of those states, we have to get our legislators first to vote to advance this constitutional amendment, and then we need to have this provision come before the people and for the people to vote for it to be made part of their constitutions.
Now, the Green Amendment movement has a history, doesn't it? The constitutional amendments at the state level and maybe even the federal level. Rachel Carson, you write about this in your book and in the foreword as well, Mark Raffalo. This goes back to the 1960s. Didn't states start writing this into their constitution? You talk about this language that exists in so many constitutions. It goes back to the civil rights era.
It does. It goes back, but unfortunately, at the time in the 60s and the 70s, when you had most of these provisions being crafted and being put forth, again, they were placed at a lower level in the constitutional document. They described protecting the environment as good public policy, or they talked about protecting the environment as being a good that the legislators should protect. So if your legislators pass bad environmental protection laws that don't protect the quality of your water and the quality of your air, your constitutional right has been vindicated, but you're no better off. That's why when I talk about a Green Amendment, I talk about using key language that puts that right to a healthy environment in the Bill of Rights section, places it on par with those other fundamental freedoms, makes sure that we don't place the obligation to protect the environment in the hands of legislators through passage of laws, but that we state it as an absolute right that people can rise up and defend when they are violated, and that it's critical that the language include protection of the environment for both present generations and future generations.
But you are standing on the shoulders of that previous movement. You are building on Rachel Carson's work and the work of those who stood alongside her in the 60s, and I would say early 70s, to try and get this Green Amendment going.
Absolutely. Standing on the shoulders, or hopefully side by side, with Rachel Carson and also Franklin Curry, right, who was the visionary in the state of Pennsylvania that put forth the language of Article 1, Section 27 back in 1971. So there are so many wonderful people who I really do feel that I'm standing with in trying to get this important cause over the finish line and get this constitutional recognition in all of our constitutions. And again, also at the federal level, because the only way we're going to hold the president accountable and the current Congress accountable for all the devastating assaults they are inflicting on our environment, on our communities, and on our kids when it comes to environmental violence is through a constitutional provision in the federal constitution.
I'm Jamie Floyd. I'm speaking with environmentalist and Delaware riverkeeper Maya K. Van Rossum. Her book is The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment. And I do want to ask you about the federal level. That's exactly where I was going to turn next. Gaylord Nelson, of course, proposed adding an environmental amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but of course that was quickly shot down. Do you really think one is going to pass now? We've got this dysfunctional Congress. We have a president who is no friend to the environment. I don't think I'm being terribly partisan when I say that. I think an objective journalist can say that this president is no friend to the environment. You have Scott Pruitt at the EPA. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try, but is it really productive at this point to focus on a federal amendment? Even amending the Constitution to do anything is so difficult. Maybe it's better to focus your efforts on the state.
Well, that's where I believe the movement begins. I do believe that we begin in the states, because I believe that that is the place where communities and organizers and environmental activists can really get together, have this conversation, talk about the fact that our environmental laws are failing us, how they're failing us, and that one of the things that we can do to get on a better path with the environment is by passing a Bill of Rights provision, a Green Amendment that protects our environmental rights. I think we can do that state by state by state. And as we're going state by state by state, we'll be having this conversation, and we'll be building the power and the support and the recognition of the importance of green amendments. And we will very naturally be bringing communities across the nation to the recognition that not only do they want and need a green amendment in their state constitutions, but that we want and need one at the federal level as well.
So then you get to two-thirds in that way, because you would then create that recognition nationwide.
Yes, I think we just naturally bring people, because people do have to be brought along in this path of understanding, because what the industry says and what business says in the state of New York in imposing the green amendment being proposed in the state of New York is they argue that it's not needed, that it's not necessary, that it's not going to do any good. All we have to do is look at the state of our environment today to realize that simply relying on legislation at the local, state, and federal level isn't getting us where we need to be.
And you write about that in your book. I actually wanted to ask you, and I say two-thirds, I mean the two-thirds you need for a constitutional amendment. I want to ask you about overseas and examples from other countries, but I want to take a step back for one moment. Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, all of this environmental legislation, the EPA under Nixon, you write so eloquently about how those are regulatory, but they don't really stop pollution and polluters and industry. They just regulate. Say a little bit about that. Why aren't laws enough to give us the clean planet we deserve?
So, unfortunately, the way our environmental protection laws are written for the most part is they're not written to stop pollution, to prevent pollution, to halt pollution. They're written so as to regulate it. Very literally, if you want to pollute the water or the air or fill in a creek or fill in a wetlands, it's not illegal to do that. You just have to go to the appropriate government agency and get a permit, get permission to pollute the water, the air, and devastate the water, the wetlands and the waterways and the forests. And so as a result, we perpetuate pollution. We actually see it as a foregone conclusion, as a necessary evil, when in fact it's not. Energy is a perfect example. We can pursue our energy goals using clean energy strategies that will protect our environment, provide our energy, and create abundant jobs, more jobs, better jobs. If you do it the environmental protection way, there's always a better path. And all people have to do is do a Google search to see how our environmental protection laws are failing us. You know, I did one just the other day. Here are some of the headlines. Drinking water blamed in hundreds of illnesses. 13 deaths, 3 million Americans exposed to unsafe drinking water. Air pollution is still killing people in the United States. We can read the science that talks about how the pollution that is permitted by our current laws is causing cancer, is making children ill, is causing autism and ADHD and Alzheimer's. We are devastating every aspect of people's lives with this environmental contamination and devastation that we are allowing to happen under the current legal scheme we have. Because we're not recognizing that there's another layer that has to be looked at, the right to people to have clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment. It is an inherent right, an inalienable right, and a right that needs to be recognized in the Bill of Rights section of our constitutions, because that's the only way we're going to give it the highest level of protection under the law that it deserves and that we deserve.
And as you point out, we tend to pay attention only when there's a BP oil spill or an Exxon Valdez or a Flint, Michigan. It hits the headlines and then we go back to business as usual. Are there other countries that have the equivalent of what you seek, protections in their founding documents or some sort of larger documentary protection for their people that recognizes this right?
Yeah, we do have other countries across the world that recognize and protect our environment in their constitutions in a variety of different ways. Some to a greater extent, some to a lesser extent, but many of them very powerfully. But what I like to say when thinking about that question is that really we don't have to look to other countries for our inspiration and our guidance. we can look to Pennsylvania and we can look to Montana. And I know that in Pennsylvania, horrible things are still happening with drilling and fracking and the proliferation of pipelines. But what we have to remember is that while Pennsylvania's provision was passed in 1971, it was only given legal life just a few short years ago as the result of the litigation the Delaware Riverkeeper Network pursued.
2013.
December of 2013.
The case came down in 13?
The case came down in 13. Since December of 2013, we and others have been using the Environmental Rights Amendment to pursue other legal actions. And so there have been more decisions, including just this past summer and in 2016, that have further defined and strengthened what it means to have an environmental right in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So it's just, though, a few short years, mm-hmm. but it is powerful and it is growing. And what I like to point out to people, you know, is right now when you're an environmental advocate at a public meeting, so often you get denigrated by the people who want to see their industrial operation or development move forward. They call you a fish lover and a people hater, or a job killer, or a tree hugger, or an eco-terrorist, right? And they say that because they think that the environment is not an inalienable right that we have, that it's a luxury. But we all know it's not a luxury. If you have a constitutional provision, no longer can they call you these names, because now you're not a tree hugger or a fish lover. Now you're a patriot. You're a patriot who's rising up to defend their constitutional right to a healthy environment. That's how we need environmental activists to be looked at and embraced by the community. And that's another thing that an environmental rights amendment, a green amendment, gives us all.
So let me end by asking you this, as a patriot and someone who loves this country and this planet, how do you remain hopeful with such a daunting challenge, and particularly at this time, given those who would call names and denigrate your cause? And you write in here, I'm not going to even take on the climate deniers, the climate change deniers, but of course they're out there. So how do you remain so passionate and hopeful?
I remain hopeful and passionate because one reason is there really is no other option. If I sat down and took it, well, then we would fail. We're only going to win if we try. Right. And I remain hopeful because of all of the wonderful people I meet every day in all of the unfortunate battles for the environment I have to take on. And as horrific as things are politically right now in terms of our president and our Congress and governors and state legislators attacking the environment, not rising up to defend it the way they should, unfortunately, they're making my case for me. That our environmental protection laws today, our political system today, is not protecting the environment the way we need it protected, that something more is necessary. And I absolutely believe that the path forward, that something more that we all need, are green amendments, a right to a healthy environment, to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment in every Bill of Rights section, in every state constitution, and in our federal constitution all across the nation. Because those of us who love the environment, we are patriots. And we are patriots who are rising up to defend everyone. And having a constitutional provision in every constitution at the state and federal level will help us accomplish the job we need to protect the water, the air, the forest, the soil, and the critters for the benefit of everyone, even for the benefit of the polluters and the president.
Well, the planet has a good advocate in you, Maya. My guest has been Delaware Riverkeeper Maya K. Van Rossum. She's talking about her new book, The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment. And I want to thank you so much for coming in today to our New York studios.
Thank you so much for helping me spread the good word.
It's been a pleasure to have you here. Coming up is Susan Ronald with her biography of socialite Florence Gould. It's titled A Dangerous Woman. You're listening to Midday on WMYC, and we will be right back after a break.